So what we're doing is going through the booklet that I gave you as your there was a link in the email, the home testing booklet. And I just have to keep remembering that you can't see. I'm so used to flipping through slides and you can see it, so I know you see what's on the screen. So we're on page 2 of the booklet. And we were just...
I normally feel in the car. I hope I can't wait to get a chance to do this with the slides and the audio.
Right. Okay, so home assessment of digestion was where we started. We just were briefly going over. HCL challenge is the first one we're going to talk about, and there's book little worksheets and all that you can use in here. However, I was saying that I really prefer using bitters, and we were just discussing what the bitters are, and we'll go from there. So I prefer to use bitters if possible, but some people like to take HCL, but I don't like them to just say, oh, well, I'll just take 3 of them. My doctor said I should take 3, or my friend said I should take 3, because you can get into trouble if you're not careful about titrating it, and that's what the challenge is all about. The bowel transit time, like it says, is just to see how long it takes you to get from mouth to anus. And it should be, you know, somewhere like 18 to 24 hours. And if it's less than 18 hours, it's too fast and you're not going to be able to absorb all your nutrients. And if it's more than 24 hours, it's too slow and you're going to reabsorb all your toxins and probably tend to be constipated and not good either. So we'll talk about how we can measure that with people. Then there's the pulse testing for food allergies, which those of you who are on the FAST program are experts at, and those of you who aren't, probably have heard about it, but it's a way of testing your pulse before and after eating to see if there's a possible that you're having a sympathetic nervous system response to that food, which could suggest that you're having maybe not a true food allergy, but some sort of sensitivity your body saying no. And then another thing called Indican. Has anybody heard of Indican for intestinal malabsorption? That's not one that most people probably heard of.
No, I've never heard of it.
Okay. All right. We'll talk about that one. It's actually a little kit you can get where the person pees into a cup and you can just take a little bit of their urine and put it in a cup. It may be more advanced than what you want to get into right now, but they can also do them at home. You can send them home with it and they come with a little card, and that helps to see if they have a candida or some sort of a bacterial overgrowth in their gut. It's going to produce this chemical called Indican. And it's a pretty inexpensive test. Each of the little vials costs maybe $10. If you buy bulk of them, if you buy them singly, they're maybe $12 each. So it's not that bad compared to some lab tests that they'd have to go to a lab to do. And again, making sure that when you're speaking to your clients about these tests, that you're always in the place of wanting to let them know you're not diagnosing. You're giving them some tools that they can use at home that they can just get assessments of their body function. So it's functional assessment, not diagnosis. And it's really important that you make clear, especially if you are not a licensed practitioner that has the within the scope of license doing lab tests. So it's totally not going to get you in trouble to do these things because you're giving people this to take home. And like I said, you'll have the little worksheets that you can just take and photocopy from the booklet and hand them to take home, or you can make your own copy using Microsoft Word. So the HCL challenge test, it goes through the purpose, it goes through the procedure. The purpose is really to discover, does this person have an issue with low stomach acid, and are they a good candidate for taking HCL? Sometimes what I'll do is I'll have someone take the HCL challenge test, but then instead of having them take HCL as the therapeutic, I'll have them do the bitters and green smoothies and green juices, which helps to increase your stomach acid production. And then in a month, do the challenge test again just to see the effectiveness of those more natural herbal food-based cures or treatment. I'm using the wrong words. I'm going to get myself in trouble here. Protocols. Does everybody still hear me?
Yes. Dr.
Okay,
Rita Marie?
Yes.
When it says here, substantially complex meal, what does that mean?
That's a great question, Beatrice. A substantially complex meal is not an apple.
not a green smoothie either.
And it's not a green smoothie unless you're starting to put stuff in your green smoothie, like you've got a lot of veggies and you put some protein powder and you put some hemp seeds and coconut, then that becomes substantially complex.
It's a combination of fats and greens and vegetables and other things.
And other things, right, combination foods. So in the meat and potatoes world, it's meat and potatoes is a complex meal, right? It's a starch and a protein, which just the two of those together is takes a lot of digestive juice to digest. And it's something, anything that has a lot of protein in it would be substantially complex, right? Because that's where your body needs the HCL. Okay? And then, and you don't, the reason that for having it be a substantially complex meal is that you don't want to be having them put stomach acid into their stomach when they're eating an apple. Because they don't need a lot of stomach acid to digest that apple. But if they have a piece of steak, they're going to need a lot of it. And if they don't need the stomach acid, it's going to burn a hole through their stomach. And that's where you have to be careful.
Okay, Dr. Rita Marie, then are vegetables, for example, zucchini, the zucchini pasta, that wouldn't be considered?
Nah, no. When you're doing this test, you want a complex. So on a raw foods meal, it's like lasagna, pizza, a nut pate stuffed inside of a zucchini. Right, but just some zucchini pasta is just really, that's not complex enough. And you might run into trouble where even just taking the one HCL is going to cause them a lot of pain. If it's a really complex meal and you add one HCL tablet, generally speaking, the person might feel, if they don't need it, they'll feel a little bit of warmth in their stomach. They may feel a slight amount of burning, in which case we have a little procedure in here what to do if they do get something like that, which is to alkalize, like, have some baking soda in water and alkalize it. But for the most part, but if they do a very light meal and they take one HCL capsule, it could be too much and it can be very irritating to the gastric mucosa.
Okay.
Okay? All right. So it says in red, things in red are things we pay attention to, right? In red, it says do not take on an empty stomach. Okay? And do not open the capsules and take as a powder. And that's really, you really have to make sure that you tell somebody this if you're giving them this test and if you're doing it yourself. And I totally recommend that before you recommend any of these tests to other people, that you do them on yourself. That you really feel comfortable and know what it's all about, what it feels like. If you open up the capsules, you can eat away holes into your mouth and into your esophagus, especially your esophagus. And you don't want that to happen. So you make sure that you take it in the capsule. You take one, and you follow the directions exactly. Okay?
Okay.
So the way that you do it is day one, you have it with the meal, and you really have to watch. You have to pay close attention after you eat the meal. If you just eat it and then you go running around and you're doing all sorts of stuff, you may miss the sign. That's a little bit of an extra warmth in your stomach. Right? It might be a slight discomfort or a warmth. Right? Make sure you focus on that because that means stop. You don't need the HCL or it's contraindicated. And it may not mean you don't need it, but it may mean that you have enough of a disruption of your mucous membrane in your gut that you need to do a lot of buildup of that mucous membrane before you give it to them. And sometimes what I like to do before I even give somebody this test to do is I'll put them on a course of maybe, a week or two or three of DGL licorice. That's the deglycerizinated licorice and slippery elm in a combination to just help them start to rebuild and repair that lining. Sometimes that in and of itself will solve someone's digestive issues.
So right? The slippery elm helps restore the lining?
Yes, it does. Yes.
Oh, I have some here.
Yes. So I would have them do like 3 weeks of DGL and slippery elm before you even have them do this test. And the only reason you're going to do a test like this is if somebody's been going for a long time and they've had that burning feeling or they burp right after they eat and they just have those symptoms. And when we go through the full-on practitioner training, I have a whole thing on digestion, you'll get to know what are those symptoms that indicate low stomach acid. Low stomach acid is very often misdiagnosed. It's misdiagnosed for excess stomach acid because some of the symptoms are similar to ulcer pains. burning after eating, discomfort. And a lot of people that have a low stomach acid are put on what? Antacids. Is that a good thing to do with somebody that already has low stomach acid? No. So you would be doing this test with somebody who you suspect has low stomach acid. And indeed, they don't. And they're not getting better with all these antacids that they're taking. Real clear sign. Okay? So the basic procedure is you do that the first day they take one. They're really careful. The next day, the same thing, the first complex meal, they take two. And the way you take HCL is not like before you put the food in your mouth, when I say the beginning of the meal. It means take a bite or two of the food, take one. If you're doing two, take a few more bites of the meal, take two. Similarly to the way that your body will be producing it. It's just dripping it out slowly throughout the meal as more and more gets in there. It's not just dumping this whole boatload of HCL right at the beginning. So you want to do that, and you don't want to run the risk of there not being food in there to buffer the lining of the stomach. Okay? You want to make the meal similar to the day before. So if one day you had a salad with pistachios on it, and the next day you had lasagna, those are not similar in complexity. So make them similar so you're comparing apples to apples, not apples to oranges. Right? Once you've figured out what you need for the complex meals, then you can play around with the test and see if you need it and how many, and most likely a lot less for more simple meals. Okay? And then the third day you go to three, the fourth day you go to four. If they get to four and they're not getting that warmth or burning sensation, then I would stop at four. I wouldn't go beyond. I'm not saying I've never gone beyond four, but I've been doing this a long time. And I would say if you haven't been doing this a long time and really have a good sense of it, stop at four and just say, okay, before each meal you take four of the, or at the beginning, and you explain to them how to take it. You know, take one, eat a little, take two, eat a little, take a third. And you just do this for a month and let's see how it goes. All the while, they're tuning in to make sure that they don't start to get a little bit of burning, because if you are giving them the HCL and also giving them the bitters, that's going to stimulate their own digestive juices going. And you want their body to take over so they don't have to take the HCL anymore. Which is why I'm going to go back to my original statement. My favorite way to do this is to test with the HCL challenge, say, huh, they needed four. They're going to need a lot of bitters. If they're willing to comply, then you get them to do bitters. But you know, sometimes it's easier for people to just carry around a bottle of pills, and that's what they want to do. And with bitters, you can get a formula of bitters, or you can have somebody juice dandelion or arugula and drink an ounce or two of that and swish it around in the mouth about 15 minutes before they eat, and that stimulates your stomach to produce its own. But if somebody's very depleted, like they get to four and they don't feel it at all, most likely a combination of the two is going to be what they need, a very short period of time with the HCL and careful monitoring. So even though this is the first test in the book, as I think about this, I'm going to move this to be one of the last tests in the book, because it's not the best one to start with, because it does really, you just want to be careful with it. But if you're feeling comfortable with it, say you've done it on yourself, you know exactly what it's about, you can use this thing on page four, which is the HCL challenge test tracking page. And you just have them keep track. Because you know, even if they don't write it down, 2 days later they're not going to remember what happened 2 days later. They're not going to remember if they had zucchini pasta or lasagna 2 days before, if they didn't write it down or what their reaction was. So you make sure you get them to write it down, especially on this test.
Rita Marie, we have been taught that it's best to do that HCL challenge in the middle of a meal. Is that, obviously you feel like it's better to just have a very small amount of food before you...
You know, you would be safer to do it in the middle of the meal. But it's just, the way I was taught was to start after the first few bites of meal, eat a few more bites, eat another one, a few more bites, eat another one. But
okay.
Doing it in the middle of the meal is a safe way to do it, and it's actually not a bad idea for the first, you know, few times you have somebody try it.
Especially for patients that have had really a lot of trouble, that,
yep.
You know, you have the suspicion that they may you know, even have an ulcer or...
Right, right, exactly.
And would this be contraindicated in anyone who's had...
you would never do, thank you, never do it in somebody who has a history of an ulcer.
Right.
Even if it's healed and they're fine, no, don't do it
right.
in somebody. Or gastritis or some indication, whether they've had a biopsy or some sort of a imaging technique that showed that they have low... mucus lining. And that's why I say if you are suspicious about this, it might not be a bad idea to just do a course of DGL and the slippery elm for a month or so, 3 weeks to a month, just to get their lining built up a bit before you try this. And that may do the trick. You know, marshmallow is another one. Aloe vera is another one.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Rita Marie, I'm going to ask you something I've heard all my life also, aside from not losing weight when you're older, is it standard that older people have very low stomach acid?
It actually is true that as we age, our stomach acid goes down.
Well, one for them, yes.
Yes. And guess what? Who's on more antacids than everybody else?
They are.
The older population, right? So it's like, yeah, they give you know, one point, as you said, but why are these people on antacids? If they naturally lose stomach acid as they age, don't you think that maybe their stomach burning is caused by low stomach acid? You have a 22-year-old, a robust 22-year-old, and they're complaining about acid, you know, regurgitation and all. There's a good possibility that they have too much acid. But you have a 65-year-old frail person? Not that I'm saying 65-year-olds are frail. I'm too close to that to think about being frail in 10 years. But I know a lot of very, very spunky 65-year-olds who are running marathons. But, yeah, an 85-year-old, I'll say like my mother-in-law who's almost 90, am I going to even suspect that she has too much stomach acid? I mean, come on. No, right? So that's a great thing to bring up.
An allergist told me to take that the proton pump inhibitors for allergy testing, and I just refused to do it. Was I wrong in that?
No, you were right, yeah.
Because I was afraid that I didn't have enough stomach acid and that would really mess me up royally.
Yeah, no.
So that's just a misuse of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of misuse out there, yeah.
I was going to say one of many.
One of many,
thank you.
Deborah Lee can give us a lot of the behind the scenes there, being a PA and having been trained traditional medical realm. What I want to say is, though, if somebody gets the discomfort, even if it's just a little bit of warmth, don't let it, you know, say, don't worry about it. If it's warm, just, you know, suck it up and it'll be over soon. No, if they get a little bit of warmth, they don't want to deal with it. They can do one of these four things. If it's just a little bit of warmth, just have a nice cup of slippery elm tea. You know, make a cup of slippery elm, a teaspoon and 8 ounces of water, warm water, and you can add a little peppermint or ginger or whatever you want to add to it, something, you know, mild. Maybe not peppermint when they're burning, but just to make it taste okay for them. Or you can make a tea like chamomile tea, and then you can add some slippery elm to the tea after you've taken the tea bag out, because otherwise it'll be a big mess. And you can have them drink that, and that will soothe it. I have done things like, you know, I go crazy. I told you about my licorice experiments. I've done ginger experiments. Like, if I make ginger juice, how much ginger juice can I drink in one sitting before it causes me stomach discomfort? So I've done that. And if I get that discomfort, what do I have to do to get rid of it? Because, you know, my general life, I don't have the symptoms that people come to me for, but I want to have some real-life practical information to share. So I've done that with ginger juice, and then getting this, like, doubling over pain, burning in my gut. And I'm like, oh, my God, what did I do? Okay, so I make the cup of slippery elm tea. I drink the cup of slippery elm tea. Within 10 minutes, it's completely gone. So it's an awesome thing to do. If they actually get more severe burning, you might want to just go with like an antacid like Alka-Seltzer, or better than that is even just baking soda in water.
Yeah.
You know, just really that alkaline to just get that acid down quickly. But usually all it takes, if it's just real mild, if they've done it according to instructions, a cup of aloe vera, like a quarter cup, not a whole cup, but of aloe vera juice, of slippery elm, marshmallow, any of those really nice demulcents. And
chia gel? Chia gel?
You know, it could be chia gel, but I think that the others do work a little bit faster. But the chia gel has especially if you haven't blended the chia gel, you have the little seeds in there, and it's possible that if it's irritated, they may irritate. I doubt it, but certainly chia gel is a possibility. If you're home and you've done one of these experiments and you don't have any of the other things, try chia gel.
Okay? Marie, with the citral, we usually see it here as a powder. Did you say citral tea?
Citral powder, you make it into a tea.
Yeah.
So you take a teaspoon. You what?
I for myself personally, I haven't found it great for me, and I'm always surprised because people are always recommending it. But I'm wondering that maybe in another form, like maybe the does it come as leaves or?
You know what I found? If I could interject the. The slippery elm powder, I never was a fan of it either. I always thought, what's the big deal? Why does everybody flock to it for throats? And I found that when I found the plain root powder, and I mixed like a full teaspoon in a small amount of warm water and let it sit, it becomes kind of gelatinous.
Yes, it does.
It's actually kind of pleasant.
Yeah.
Actually, I don't know, one time I had it, I don't know whether I had something else in the cup or what happened, but it was a little bit sweet. And it was actually, I was talking to somebody else at the house, and I said, wow, I never realized how much I really enjoy this.
I really like it. I like the way it feels. And I've seen some amazing results. I had a friend over, and she had a sore throat. She was coughing, and I said, oh, here, take some slippery elm. And I gave it to her. She goes, oh, my God, what is that stuff? Can I take some of that home with me? It just calmed her cough down immediately, and that's what it's done to me. And I know people that I've counseled with that I've been working with who are dealing with the stomach burning, and they call it, like, my new best friend is slippery elm. So it could be that maybe it's not fresh. And in answer to whether there's another form, it's actually a bark. It's the bark of a tree. And I've gotten it where I've gotten the actual whole slivers of bark. Oh, don't waste your money. Because even the Vitamix can't break it down into a powder. It's just
a coffee grinder.
I haven't tried it in a coffee grinder because it was a little bit big for the coffee grinder. But I had this monk blue. I couldn't get it to do anything, so it's a waste.
I stuck half cinnamon sticks in my coffee grinder, and it made powder out of them.
But there's something because I think it's because of the gelatinous nature to it. It's not hard.
It's flexible.
It's flexible, and it just wouldn't break down. I tried. It actually got moisture. I think some of the moisture then made the powder clump, and it did turn into powder. So I didn't find that very useful. You might try switching brands if you're not finding it to be as effective. Yes. I usually use Frontier, or I've used both Frontier and Mountain Rose Herbs with great success.
I think here they sell it loose in health shops quite often.
There you go.
So it might have been sitting around and stale. I think that's probably for me what it is.
Maybe that's it.
Yeah, and also sometimes you can't be totally sure that if it's come in from another country, you can't be totally sure it hasn't been irradiated sometimes.
Oh.
So that's something that I'll look into.
Yeah.
For instance, we probably couldn't import that, like the one that you said.
Those brands,
So I'll look around because it sounds like it's definitely worth
It's worth it if you can get some good stuff. Now, the other thing is, that said, there's biochemical individuality, right? So maybe that isn't the right one for you for whatever reason. And you might try marshmallow because you can do the similar thing with marshmallow. You make this kind of a gruel thing. You put a teaspoon of it, you put the water in it, and it turns into this mucilaginous stuff. You can flavor it, and then you can drink it. So play around with that. You know, it's certainly, it's worth that, yeah.
Tends very
to be,
similar.
They are very similar, yeah. The marshmallow, it traditionally tends to be used more for urinary tract irritation, and slippery elm tends to be used more for digestive and respiratory. And does that mean they don't cross? No. Another thing that could be useful is plantain. Plantain is also a mucilaginous, and that's something you can get fresh, actually. We just go out to the yard, and we just pick it as a weed, and that's very, very soothing as well. Okay?
Yeah, thank you.
All right, so the interpretation, if they don't get any pain at all and they get all the way up to 4, is that they probably have very low stomach acid. And if they immediately get a little bit of pain or discomfort or warmth, and then they probably don't really need it. And so most likely what you want to be doing is looking, if they're having digestive issues, looking at enzymes, looking at leaky gut, looking at repairing the mucous membrane, which is, you know, a story for another day, as they say. So let's, and there's a whole thing about the signs and symptoms. So you really, I forgot that I had all that in there. And it's even blood tests that's suggestive. That's kind of interesting, and we'll be going through a lot more of that on another time, but you can read that so you can kind of glean. I'm going to be starting in September a complete, probably 2 to 3 months. I haven't decided on the exact length until I figure out the content, but of how to interpret your people's, you know, blood tests and doing assessments. And finding things like this, like low stomach acid from a blood test, who'd have known, right? And it's all right there, clear as day. Okay? So bowel transit time. How long does it take to go? Like I said, 18 to 24 hours is ideal. This is on page, I'm sorry because I forget
seven.
Again that you can't see.
Page 7.
Page 7, thank you. So page 7 is bowel transit time. You're going to use charcoal, which is an inert substance that doesn't get absorbed. And you're going to see how long it takes to go through the system. It gets broken down, but it just doesn't get absorbed. You can also use corn. Some people will use corn, but corn is like, it's a little tricky because it could be an allergen and it could stimulate their digestion. And if they're not chewing the corn well, which most people don't, then you're going to see the whole kernels in there. But if they're really good at chewing their corn and getting it down, you may not even see it come out as whole pieces. So I prefer to use the charcoal. So you can get those at your local health food store, and you're supposed to just swallow 4 of them at your evening meal, and you write down the exact time and date on a chart, and there's a chart here, and then you watch after every bowel movement after that, you observe your stool for the very first time of sign of any kind of black or gray, rather than brown or green, as a lot of us would tend to have from all the green smoothies. It would be more black or gray. And so you just write that down. And you want to make sure it's bright. You know, if you're in the middle of the night and you're groggy and you can't see, oh, yeah, that looks fine. But observe it in a bright light, you know, even if you have to bring a flashlight into your bathroom in the middle of the night. So you write that time down. And then you go to, you wait till all of that disappears. So you just eat normally after the charcoal meal, and then when you no longer see the sign, then that gives you an idea of how long the charcoal took to go through your system. Now, some will argue that charcoal may go through the system at a different rate than food, and arguably so, depending on how much fiber is in the food and how much fat's in the food, everything's going to be a little bit different. But we're really just looking for a ballpark. If somebody says 3 days later, they finally saw a gray or black stool, you know that person has a little bit of a problem, don't you think? Sluggish bowels. And even if they're having a bowel movement every day or even 2 or 3 times a day, they can be have slow transit time. So if you're having 3 bowel movements a day, but what you're eliminating is the food you ate 3 days ago, technically speaking, you really are constipated, because that food is sitting in you way too long. And this is what this test will observe. And again, if you eat the charcoal and 4 hours later you have a bowel movement and there's charcoal in there, it says one of two things. Either the charcoal was an irritant and stimulated you to have an extra bowel movement, or you're just eliminating your food too quickly. Now, if you tend to have bowel movements within 4 hours or, you know, within a short period of time after eating anyway like that, and it wasn't really an irritant, and it's black, you know that you're passing your food way too quickly and you're not absorbing your nutrients.
Okay? Dr. Rita Marie, in that case, wouldn't you be very, very slim if you're not absorbing the nutrients?
You would think, and most people who have increased transit time do tend to be thin, but I've seen it go the other way. It's like they're not, the sugars get absorbed really easily through the lining of the stomach even, And we know that, don't we, because we test our blood sugar.
Don't we know that?
We know that sometimes the sugar gets absorbed under our tongue because you can, and I want to experiment with that sometime. Just put some a kind of real sweet juice or something under in my mouth and not swallow it and see how long it takes my blood sugar up. So we know that the sugars get absorbed real easily. So that would be the thing. If somebody's eating a lot of sugar, that's just going right in. So, but it's a good question, very good question. Okay? So that's basically it. And then you have a chart on page 8. Yes? Question?
Is there something else we can use apart from charcoal or corn?
I haven't come up with it, but if you rack your brain and you think of anybody. Oh, beets, yeah. But beets are a little bit more challenging because once you chew them, the juice comes through and kind of flows, so the solid may not be coming through, but the juice may be coming through ahead of the solid.
Quinoa is one.
Quinoa?
But the sprouted, not necessarily the cooked. Because
the sprouted, yeah, maybe things like that like lentil sprouts maybe. If you find that there's things that you're not chewing properly and you're finding them in the toilet, then any of those things could be a good guideline, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So if you sometimes see sunflower seeds in coming out the other end, and those would be good, but you also want to see, like, people say, I don't understand it, I saw sunflower seeds come out in my poop and I haven't eaten sunflower seeds in 3 weeks. Well, honey, you got a problem there. Yeah. Or if you happen to be doing some intestinal cleansing formulas, like you're something that's causing a cascara thing to cause your contraction, what it's doing is it's saying that you are probably storing some of that stuff in the diverticuli in the pockets and it's coming out. So yeah, which is also a problem if you're storing things in your diverticuli because it's not supposed to do that. Okay, so on page 8 you have a chart and you can teach people how to fill that out. And then on page 9 we have the pulse testing for individual foods. And this was first written about by a Dr. Coco, the Coco Pulse Test, or Coca? I can't remember if it's Coco or Coca. But he wrote a book. There's a little book called The Pulse Test. And basically the idea is that before you sit down to a meal, you take your pulse, and then you eat your meal, and then at the end of the meal you take your pulse, and you see what the difference is, right? And if a food is causing you to have a problem, it could be creating an increase in your pulse because it's causing a stress on your system. Okay? And if you eat a meal with multiple foods, say you can do this by testing foods one at a time, or you could just eat your normal meals and write down what's in the meal and then take your pulse. And any time your pulse does go up, all the foods in that meal are suspicious. And then you have to go back and test them, similar to what we did when we were doing the food allergy, for those of you who took the FAST program. Okay,
Is there an amount that it goes up by that would be like if it goes up more than 5 or 10?
More than 10. Yeah, more than 10. And you're going to be doing it at multiple times. I usually like to do it right after, before and then right after. But really the telling ones also are good at 30, 60, and 90 minutes.
Okay.
Because you also want to see how long it keeps your pulse up. Right? It could be your pulse went up, but it was because the doorbell rang and the dog started barking. And you jumped up to see. Right? So there's some it's not a perfect test, but it definitely gives people guidelines. And it's a lot less expensive than getting poked and taking 14 vials of blood and sending off to a lab.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Right?
On a previous call, I said that I bought an oximeter for that reason because I thought it would be helpful. You know, the little thing that you stick on your finger.
Oh, to get your pulse ox. Yes, that's the one I want to add to this.
And actually, I don't know if it's mine, but I didn't find it. I have to admit, I didn't find it very helpful because it's so accurate that it changes all the time. So I guess, if you sit down and take your blood pressure, the meter gives you 70 beats a minute, but with the oximeter, I don't know if it's just mine, it fluctuates all the time, like every second it's...
Yes, great question. I'm going to tell you what that is, and I'll tell you how HeartMath uses that. That's called your heart rate variability, And our heart rate is instantaneously changing. And there's a wave at which it changes. And if you're stressed, that variability is going to be kind of like really jagged. Like maybe it's 74, 72, 67, 72, and it's just jumping up and down. And if you plotted it out, it would be jagged. That's a stressed out heart rate variability. And if you're calm, it'll be just nice. And it goes 60, 65, 60, 65, 60, and it goes up and down. And I'm saying it goes the gradations in between, but that's what it would look like on a graph. With the pulse oximeter, it's taking it immediately. When you do it with, when you count it, you're doing it for 15 seconds or 30 seconds. So it's kind of evening out the heart rate variability and coming out with the average, which is what it really is. But if you do that instantaneous, you're going to see it different all the time, right? So the old-fashioned way of sticking your fingers on the artery and looking at a watch is the way to go. So good, but
it's, my gadgets.
I like my gadgets too, girl. Oh, and the way HeartMath does, there's a they have a thing called the EM wave, and they also have a software program that goes with it, and you can stick your finger in the little meter, and it checks your pulse, and it graphs it. And you watch it on the screen, and then they have you do different exercises, and they even have these little pictures you can look at to get the feeling for what it looks like when you're in that nice, smooth wave. And that's what we're targeting for when we go to our appreciation and we go, when I go to the beach. And I've played around with my little meter. I've watched it, you know, go from and my son loved it because we were on a plane one time and he was playing around with it. He must have been 8 years old at the time, and he's playing around with it. He goes, Mom, look, I figured this thing out. Watch. He goes, I know how to make it go red. And he was like, he just like snarled up his face and he got all like, and you could see it going already. He goes, watch, I know how to make it go green. And then he breathed and he smiled. 8 years old, he figured the thing out. So it is a great biofeedback tool. So you might be able to figure out how to use your pulse ox. But if it, I don't know if it grasps it.
I just got the M wave actually, because I realized that I'm I can get.
Oh, good.
It's really fun, I must say. It's also really fun using
it. It is. It's a good way to do it. Great. Okay. So that's basically the pulse thing, and we've got the little the chart that you can use. And then there's a pulse diet record, so you can use that. Whichever one you like, you can use. Or you can make up your own. Yeah? I even put in your elimination provocation tracking form so that you can, when you've done the pulse test, of foods that work well for you are foods that keep your pulse steady. Suspicious foods are foods that maybe you ate in combination with other foods, and they cause your pulse to go up, so you don't want to say that they're good yet, and you don't want to say that they're bad yet. And then once you have a food that, after trying it 3 times, it consistently makes your pulse go up, you put it in the stressful food list. So it's a great way to do some allergy testing. It's a little time-consuming. But, you know, you just have to feel out the people you're working with. Some people just love doing stuff like that, and other people, like, cringe at the thought of it. So feel people out and go for it. The next one, I think this is the last one in the digestive. When you have a bacterial or a fungal or a candida overgrowth in your gut, your body produces a bunch of different toxins, basically. And indican is one. It's called, in the class of chemicals called indoles. And it's basically the breakdown of tryptophan, which is an amino acid, in your intestine. So it's important, if you are going to test this, that you have protein meals, that you don't just have fruit and then test for this, because then there's not going to be very much tryptophan in the meal. So eating typical mixed meals that would have a combination of protein and you know, fat and carbohydrate that would have tryptophan in it would give you an idea. And I guess, I never thought about this until this very second, I guess if you really wanted to check a challenge, you could just take a big dose of tryptophan and then test your indican. Why not? I'm going to have to do some research on that one. That might work. I have a whole bunch of these tests at home. And you, basically, the way that you do it, there's little vials, and the vials have a lid. Here's a picture on page, so are we on page 10 now or 9? 13. 12. No, wait. 13.
13, yeah.
Yeah, 13, on page 13, tells you what you need. Well, you have to have freshly voided urine, and it does, it should be freshly voided. If you save it for later, like if they're going to bring it to you and you're going to test it, they want to keep it refrigerated, you do want it to come to room temperature. It's just, it works better at room temperature.
I don't think it's are going to save anything in the refrigerator, Dr. Rita Marie.
Well, you know, I've had people, you don't know what I've done with people. I've had people save their urine, collect 24 hours worth, put it in the refrigerator, and take it into me. Some people are dedicated. They're dedicated.
Okay.
They do. They do. But some people go, you want me to what? Why can't I just come into the office and pee for you? So basically, fresh urine. The Indican test vial, you'll see that off to the right-hand side. It's just a little bottle. It has this little yellow kind of reagent in it. And you, or actually just has a little bit at the bottom. And you basically put the urine in, five mLs of urine. And then there's a dropper. And you basically, let's see, you use the dropper to pull up the 5 mLs. You put it in there. So once you do that, you shake it in a certain way. You got to be really careful because there's chemicals in there that aren't very good for you. And you shake it a little bit, and you very slowly open the vial to let off a little gas, and you'll actually hear a little shh. And then you close it again, and then you shake it gently again, and you do it a couple of times. And the test comes with the instructions. And then you look to see what color, if it's a positive color. It should be clear or that very, very pale. It's a very, very pale blue. It's hard to tell in the picture. But all the way down to black, and I've seen it black, and you sometimes have this sediment that forms in the bottom. And that means that they really, really have a lot of bacterial overgrowth or candida overgrowth in their gut. Okay? And that's the way you do it.
Does it only mean, like, unfriendly bacteria? Like if someone's taking acidophilus?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Then acidophilus wouldn't make it go black.
Nope. Yep. The lactic acid producing bacteria don't do it. Right. Okay. And then you put them on a good diet. You know, take them off all their sugars. You might put them on some oregano and some of the other antifungal type things. And then you have them retest it. On the page 14, I give you conditions that would give you elevated levels, different things that could cause it, you know, maldigestion, low stomach acid, ulcers, cancer, low stomach enzymes, et cetera, and you can have those and refer to those as well. All right. So any questions about digestion before we move on to acid-alkaline balance?
That's pretty much it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, acid-alkaline. So who's not tested pH before? Anybody? Urine pH?
Not recently. I forgot the kit. I haven't used it.
But okay. So basically a lot of these are color tests. So you're basically looking to see the degree of something or the pH or whatever by looking at your results versus a color chart. And you'll see on page, was it 14? 15? Yeah, page 15. You have a picture, and that's your acid alkaline tester, your pH paper. Okay, it may look different. Some places will get them in little strips, and some of them look like that. This is a very common brand here in the United States. Now, important that you get the right range. 5.5 to 8 seems to be a good range. You know, if it's 4.5 or 5 to 8 is good. The ones that are wider ranges, like you say, oh, well, why don't I just get a wider range? You know, this one goes from 1 to 14. You're not going to be able to see the detail. You're not going to be able to get as precise. So it's best to do the range that you're expecting to get. Like a little bit lower than that would be fine, but you don't want it to be. If theirs goes down to 5.5, you don't care if it's 4.5 or 3. You just know that they have very, very low stomach acid. I mean, very low urine pH, which you don't want it to be. You want it to be more like 6.8, okay? And if it's over 8, then it's pretty alkaline, and it's the opposite end of the spectrum. So that one's a good range, okay? So basically, you know, our tissues run better when they're alkaline-forming. Cancer forms worse in an acid environment. Stomach pH is different from blood pH. Stomach needs to be acid. Your mouth needs to be alkaline. Your blood needs to be alkaline slightly. The average is about 7.38 is actually closer to what the precise level of acid alkalinity in your bloodstream would be. So, foods, certain foods, you've seen the food chart. I think there's one in here. If not, there's one on my website and there's one, you know, plenty of places you can get. So basically, let's talk about the various kinds of tests that you can do. Some of these were new to me when I first learned about them. And some of these I don't do very often. I don't do this breath holding test. I just don't do the breath holding test. It's not one that I do very often. But you can actually see how long you can hold a deep breath. And if you can't hold your breath, you let it out, and then you look it on the chart. So if you can't hold your deep, whoops, I just moved my page too quickly. If you find it difficult to hold your breath on your own like this and time at the same time, then get somebody to help you with it. Okay? It is best to do it lying down, but you want to make sure that you're just not, you know, you want to breathe as normally as you possibly can. Okay? So they're going to watch you rise and fall. I'm reading this going, wait, this isn't the right test. There's two different tests. So the breath holding is how long can you hold your breath. Okay? The longer you can hold your breath, the more oxygen in your breath, the less carbon dioxide in your breath, and that gives you an idea of your pH. Let me go to page, let me go show you this thing. Page 18, there's a chart where you could put it on. I think my instructions weren't as clear as they could be. Let me just look. I think we'll have to update this. Okay. Yeah, so if your blood is too acidic, you're not going to be able to hold your breath as long. So that's one thing. Like I said, I never use this test, so I'm a little bit rusty on it. As far as the respiration rate, you write down the respiration rate. If they take they're breathing too much, they're probably more acid. If they're not breathing enough, they're probably more alkaline. Okay, average is about 12 to 16 breaths in a minute. But the ones that I find the most useful are the urine pH and the salivary pH, number 3 and 4. So what your urine pH, you want to measure your urine pH the first thing in the morning, because that's overnight is when your body is getting rid of its wastes. And you want to see, like, how much waste do I really have to do? So if you've got a lot of acidic residue in your system, it's going to be accumulating and you're going to be eliminating it in your urine, and your urine is going to be more acidic. Okay? So you tear off a strip about 3 inches long. You get your saliva. It's not great to stick the thing in your mouth, but pull up some saliva in the front of your mouth, stick it in there, look at the chart, jot it down. Ideally, your first morning urine, I just did the saliva. Your first morning saliva is going to be 6.8 to 7.2. For the urine, you just pee in a cup and then you stick it in there. Or if you're good at it, you can stick it in your urine stream. As long as, you know, sometimes we get a little bit messy if we try to do that. So that's what I mean, if you're good at it, if you can aim well. If you don't want to risk getting messy, just pee into a cup and then stick the strip in there. All right. What you want that to be is between 6.4 and 6.8. That's usually the right range, because you are going to be a little bit more acidic in the urine first thing in the morning. If you're 6.8 to 7.2, not a problem. If you're above 7.2, then you actually might be too alkaline, or you might be too acid and you're producing a lot of ammonia, which is your body's buffering system.
So the ideal urine is 6.4 to 6.8?
Yeah, 6.4 to 6.8. Okay. That's listed on page 18.
Okay.
Okay? Now you could, you can see this. You can also take the second urine pH. So if the person, say you do your urine and it's like 6.2, you know, a little bit too acid, but then your second urine is 7.1. It's more of a short-term acute thing. You may be looking at, what did I eat for dinner last night? Who did I yell at and get upset with last night? What was going on last night to make me more acidic? Whereas if the second urine is also in the acidic range, then you know you have more of a deep-seated problem that you're going to be needing to work on. Okay? For some people, they just, all they need to do is take the chart. They work on changing the foods for a week. They eat like 75% alkaline, 25% acid for a week, and everything goes into balance. For other people, it's more long-term. How stressed are their adrenals? That'll affect the pH as well. Okay? The next test is one I do a lot of, and I really like it. It's the pH challenge test. And you basically do this with the saliva. And you want to do it away from a meal. You don't want to do it right after a meal, but say, you know, midway between lunch and dinner is typically where I would see people in the office setting. And I'll cut off 7 pieces of the strip, and the first thing you do is you prepare, because you're going to challenge with lemon juice. So you make a little lemonade with a tablespoon of lemon juice and a tablespoon of water, and then you take your first pH reading, and then you write that down. And then you immediately go and you drink the lemon juice and water solution, and you take your pH again. Well, you're going to expect that it's going to be very acidic when you first take it right after, because there's going to be still some lemon juice in there. But you want to swallow a few times to make sure that you get the residues of the lemon out of your mouth, and then start taking your other readings a minute apart. And you're going to see down below on that page, page 19, there's a little graph. So say the person's in the ideal range, they're about 6.8, and then right after the lemon they go down, that's normal, and then at a minute they're starting to come up again. And at 2 minutes they're up even higher than they started. At 3 minutes they're up higher, 4 minutes, 5 minutes, and at 5 minutes they've gone up considerably higher than they started. That's healthy. Because your body responds to an acidic challenge by alkalizing. And it's sending an acid alkaline signal, and your saliva then goes back to being even more alkaline than it started out with. And then, you know, within 10 minutes, it's probably back down to normal. But what we see is there's so many variations on this. I rarely see a normal one. I've seen a few, but I've rarely seen them. So if you look where the baseline is, a lot of times you see somebody who's too low as a baseline. That's one problem. But if at the minute you don't see it become really, right after they drink the lemon juice, it doesn't become acidic, you start to see it turning purple or dark blue, like very alkaline. What that says is that their body is hypervigilant. Their adrenals are on guard. And the body perceived a little bit of lemon juice in the mouth as a serious stress. And instead of just buffering it with some alkaline minerals and allowing it to pop back up, it sent out the ammonia. And the ammonia caused you to go straight from being at there all the way up into the much more alkaline range. So that's somebody who's stressed out. Stressed out, stressed out, stressed out. Okay? Because normally the way that we're buffering this is, oh, well, there's some acid in the mouth. Okay, well, let's shoot out, let's get some calcium and some potassium and magnesium and let's buffer it. And it takes a while to buffer it and get it back up. The other thing you might see is that the person goes down and they stay down. They don't have a response. That's a very depleted person, probably somebody who's in the state of adrenal exhaustion. And then you'll see all kinds of variations in between. When we do the more detailed assessments thing, we can go into what all those different things mean. But just keep track of it. Date, baseline, 1 minute, 1 minute, 1 minute later, you know, all the way up till you've done 7 of them. And just see what the graph looks like. And what you can do is you've got this normal one. You can actually make copies of this and plot their numbers right next to normal so they'll be able to see. Or ask them to do that if they're doing it at home. Okay. And let's see. So that's it for the pH stuff. The ones that, I'm sorry, I was a little bit fuzzy on those breathing ones because I haven't looked at that in a while and I haven't done them in a really long time, so I'm kind of rusty. The others I do a lot of, and that's why I'm much more familiar, and they're much easier to do. And they're more direct measurements, which is what I like. Any questions about pH challenge before we go on to hormones?
Nope.
Good. All right, so hormone assessments, well, blood sugar monitoring, we are all experts at that by now. So I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on that, but you've got what you need to be able to teach people how to do that. And the stuff that's in here may be a little bit out of date, and maybe not quite as detailed as some of the stuff I've taught you in Before Be Gone, because, you know, new things, new research, et cetera, so I may not have had the as fine-tuned. But you've got some charts in here. You've also got your charts from your IRSPT and your Before Be Gone that you can
use. I have a question on this, Dr. Rita Marie.
Sure.
Several times I have gotten, when I test my blood, fasting blood sugar, let's say 120,
yeah.
And if I think it's too high considering on what I've done the day before, I retest. Sometimes I've gotten 20 or 25 points lower than that on the second test right after.
Yeah, that's a great question. I have seen that too, and sometimes it's just, you know, a little glitch in the meter. What I've done, if I get a number and I'm not expecting it, like I know my blood, fasting blood sugar is always in the 70s to 80s.
Yeah.
And if I get up and I measure it and it's off, I go back and test it again and probably test it two more times.
Okay.
And if it's erratic and it goes to the 80s and then it goes back to 120 and goes to the 80s and 120, then there's something wrong with your machine.
Well, what I've done is, you know, they send you this little liquid to test it.
Yes.
And so I retest it, and the times I've done that, it's come out okay.
Okay.
So
it's just a glitch, and it may be, you know, we have a constant regulating mechanism, like Bayari pointed out for us, like the heart rate. If you test something, you're bound to catch it at a point where it's going up, and your body's bringing it right back down.
That's okay.
Right? It's unusual for morning like that, because typically you haven't eaten for a long time. But it's just anytime you get a really weird number, just retest it.
Yeah, that's what I've been doing, and if it came out weird again, actually I just ignored it.
Well, if it came out high again, Beverly,
yes.
Beatrice, all the B's on this call today, Barry, Beatrice, Beverly.
I ignored it, but I was careful with what I ate and what I did that day.
Yeah. Ignoring is different. Like, if you ignore it, it's like, there is a sign there that's like, maybe I was stressed overnight. Maybe I was worried. Maybe, just use it. We don't want you worrying about these things, but we want you learning to use them to empower you to find out, well, what's different? If you wake up with a stomach ache, you're not going to ignore it. You're going to go, what did I do yesterday? You know, what happened? What caused that? So, because there's usually, we don't just randomly get symptoms or get imbalances. There's something that caused it. So, it's just cause for not alarm, but curiosity and empowerment.
And empowerment, beware.
Yes, exactly. Well, beware. Now, let's be careful about using the word beware. Because beware, to me, smacks of fear.
Well, the way I use it is be aware.
Be aware. I like that. Yes, be aware.
Be aware of what you're doing, what you're thinking, because I've realized that our thinking really can bring our blood sugar up and down and all over the place.
Yes.
So what you're doing, what you're thinking, and what you're eating. And by doing, I mean exercise.
Mm-hmm.
How you're moving, I should say it's better, how you're moving, what you're eating, and what you're thinking. Be aware of that.
Be aware. I like that syllable, that a syllable put in there has a whole new meaning. When you said beware, my body contracted.
Oh, no.
In fear. And when you said be aware, my body opened.
Be aware.
And like, be aware. That's what we want to be. So, yeah. And I would just, and you know what you mean when you say beware, but if you're talking to clients, they don't necessarily. So I would just make sure to add that aware.
Thank you.
No, you're welcome. So the other things we're going to talk about. Oh, go ahead.
Sorry. I actually do have a couple of questions about the testing.
Yes.
I think I wrote this question ages ago, and I'm sorry if you answered it and I never heard it. How often is it okay to change the Lancet? Like, if we change the Lancet every day, is that enough, do you think?
Okay. I'm going to tell you an off-the-record answer, okay? I'm not going to tell you how often you should change the Lancet. I'll just give you an idea of how often I change the Lancet. How's that? Okay?
Okay.
According to the rules and according to the whole, you know, safety and needles and blah, 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 you should change it every time and you should use the alcohol wipe and blah, 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 blah. And even use the alcohol wipe on the lancet because you can have a drop of blood from last time. Okay. So that said, that's my due diligence. And if you tend to have a weak immune system and you tend to, you know, get cut easily and stuff, be real careful. I started out like, I can't change this every time. Why am I changing this every time? What a waste of money. What a waste of resources. There's a little plastic in there. I'm hurting the environment. Why am I doing this? So I decided I would just change it once a day. And every day I just pop in a new lancet. And then just somehow I just got out of the habit of changing it every day. And now I'll just notice, gee, that needle feels like it's not quite sharp enough anymore. I think I'll change it. I have literally gone weeks. Don't tell anybody. I have literally gone weeks, and I'm not condoning that, but I've never had a problem with that. So once a day is just fine.
Well,
okay?
I'm sure clients will probably ask us this. But
Yeah. You tell them just that. You tell them, you know, it really, ideally, you take change it every time. But if it's only you using it, and you make sure that you, you know, keep it out of the mud and that sort of thing, and you keep it clean, then once a day would be probably adequate, but you have to make a decision on your own. And I would put it back in their ball cot. You have lots of germphobics out there that are going to want to change it every time.
Okay. And another question I had from right from the beginning of the course was when I wasn't used to using it, I was thinking, when we reuse the lancet, doesn't it have blood on from before? So does that affect the reading, the new reading? Does that even make sense, that question?
You know, you asked me that before, and I thought about that, and I thought, you know, that is a good point. Is there a microscopic amount of blood still on the needle? But it doesn't seem to affect it, because think about that. I mean, if it really is, it's not visible. It's a microscopic amount, and then when you think about the piece of the pool of blood that you're getting out of there is a lot bigger, and it's kind of like if you put one drop of you know, some kind of spice that's very mild and you put it into water, it dilutes it, right? So you're not going to really notice. So that would be my answer to that. I haven't noticed any problem with it.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. So the other two that we can talk about that will be hormonal assessments, basal body temperature, and that's related to your thyroid and your adrenal to an extent too, and the Konigsberg, which is related to adrenal. Has anybody ever done basal body temperature before? Know what that is?
Yes.
Long time ago, yeah.
Yes. A lot of people know it because they've been trying to get pregnant and you're, you know, kind of trying to find the right time of the month to, you know if you've gotten your period or know if you've ovulated. But it's a really good test for thyroid. Okay. So I'm going to go back to my slides. I just was checking the thing to see if anybody else had come in that I hadn't turned on. I'm going to skip through all the blood glucose stuff because we already know that stuff. We've come up with better charts, I think, but you're welcome to use any of these charts that turn you on if you like them. And then go to page 30 where the basal body temperature. When you're testing your first morning temperature, that's usually your lowest point of the day because you've been sleeping all night, you haven't done any activity, it's going to be nice and low. That gives you the idea of what your body temperature is at rest. And it should be between, say, 97.7 and 98.2. It generally is not going to be up in the 98.6 range, which is more like middle of the day you're up and about. Basal body temperature is taken before you move. So you shake the thermometer down, you put it by your bedside, you lay down, you go to sleep, and then as soon as you wake up, you pick it up gently, you reach over just slowly, you put it under your armpit or under your tongue. The classic way to do it is armpit. I've never had very much success with getting good readings, mainly because if you fall asleep or you move too much, it doesn't stay in place. So even if you fall back to sleep a little bit with the thermometer in your mouth, you you know, you'll feel it jingle and you'll open it up. I've never had a problem with it. But you take it out, you look at the temperature, you write it down. And you chart that. For women who are menstruating, you take it within the first 7 days of the cycle. Because you don't want to get too close to ovulation, because ovulation affects it. So within the first 7 days of the cycle, if you want to test their basal body temperature to see if there's indication of thyroid. Another, Dr. Broda Barnes wrote a book all about how using basal body temperature can be used to help you diagnose hypoactive thyroid. So you monitor that for a course of 3 to 5 days, and you see where it's at. If it's lower than 97.7, then that suggests that you have low thyroid function. Does that always correlate with lab tests? No. And one of the reasons is there's a lot of things that go into, when we go into the whole blood testing thing, we talk a lot more about that, but there's a lot more than just your blood test, your TSH or your T4 or T3, that tells you how well your thyroid's functioning. You can have a problem converting between T4 and T3. You can have receptors on the cells that are resistant, just like we get insulin resistant, we can get thyroid resistant. So some people poo-poo the basal body temperature test, saying that, well, it doesn't, you know, it's not the same, and you don't get the same results as when you take a test with the blood. Well, it's not necessarily. If you have someone who has signs of low thyroid function, like lateral third of their eyebrows are missing, or they have like weird patterns of hair loss, losing their hair, other sorts of things like that, the low energy, high cholesterol, there's a whole list of those. If you have a person like that and they do a blood test and their TSH is fine and their T3 is fine and their T4 is fine, and then you say, okay, we're going to do antibodies too, and their antibodies are fine, then you're going, huh, why do they have all these thyroid signs if all the lab tests are normal? Well, I highly recommend a book by that very name, Why Do I Still Have Thyroid Problems When My Lab Tests Are Normal? It's by Dr. Datis Karazian. And basically, I suspect that that person from years of stress has burned out their receptors, and their receptors are resistant because cortisol damages those receptors, similar to how it damages insulin receptors. It damages thyroid receptors. So we use the basal body temperature test to say, uh-huh, I really think that there's an issue. And you can then deal with the adrenal issue. Put them on some adaptogens. Teach them heart math. Get them to do some mini vacations throughout the day. Support and rebuild their adrenals. And then you can go back and retest their temperature and watch the temperature come back. That's a functional test. It's a really good functional test. Are there times when it can be skewed? Sure. If the person's running a fever, has a flu, has other reasons that their temperature might be elevated, yeah, absolutely. If it's freezing cold and you have a spouse who likes to keep the temperature at 55 and you wake up in the morning with blue lips, chances are your body temperature might be low, so that's not going to be a good sign. But for the average person, it's a pretty good sign of thyroid function. Okay? And then you record it. Yeah.
May I add something here?
Yeah.
You know that I've had thyroid problems all my life, I guess, even before I was born. When I was a teenager and into my mid-20s, I never had my period within any specific number of days. So I did not have a period every 28 days or every 30 or 45.
Right.
It just came and went.
When it wanted to. Yeah.
Really. I mean, I carried sanitary napkins with me all the time because I never knew that I was going to get it. What do you do in a case like that, then?
In a case like that, you have them start the test on day one of their period, because that would be, that's when their temperature drops.
And they take it the whole period, the whole...
And they take it throughout the period, yep.
Until the next period, okay.
Well, you don't have to do it throughout the whole month. You can. We can get into more advanced stuff with body temperature. You can actually see when they're ovulating based on the temperature, or if they're ovulating.
Because I had all these problems and doctors wanted to give me progesterone and they didn't know when to do it,
yeah.
Then they would ask me to take my body temperature.
Exactly.
And call it into the office.
Exactly. And you can tell because the temperature will spike right before you're going to ovulate. And it's used for people in fertility awareness, like to prevent pregnancy. It's also used in fertility awareness to help you get pregnant. Okay, my temperature just went up. Where'd that husband go? Get him home now. So, yeah, it's very useful. There's all these old-fashioned things we used to, doctors used to do before they had all of this high-tech equipment. Yeah, and it works pretty well. You know, it's not 100%, but neither is the high-tech stuff. Okay, so then you can also pot temperature throughout the day, or you can just do the first morning urine, and that gets more complicated in terms of interpretation. You can read about that.
Dr. Rita Marie?
Yeah.
Do you think that people who have tendencies also to get hot quickly, do you agree that that's usually an adrenal issue, that if they're usually cold, but then as soon as they start to do some activity, they're like instantly taking off their shirt?
Yeah, and people with adrenal problems will tend to not sweat very well, so they don't have a real good thermal regulation. So when you don't sweat, your body tends to overheat, because sweating is your body's way of cooling down. So yeah, that's absolutely true. So people who tend to be cold all the time, right? Everybody else is sweating and they're chilly. They have cold extremities, and it's pretty consistent. That's usually more thyroid related. And I have charts that I'll share, you know, when we go through the whole process and we do the adrenal and the thyroid, that will help you to differentiate between adrenal and thyroid issues. Oftentimes they coexist, and there's a mix.
I was going to say, yeah.
Oftentimes they coexist. But you can, sometimes people think they have a primary thyroid problem and they address the thyroid their whole life when really it was an adrenal issue.
All along.
And the adrenal was causing a problem because there's something called the HPA axis, the hypothalamic pituitary axis, adrenal axis, and it basically will cause the pituitary to slow down, which is maybe what was happening with you, Beatrice, when they said you had the panhypopituitarism. But adrenals can be the biggest contributor there. Okay. Let me talk about one more test. It's a little bit trickier than the others, but it's still something people could do at home. I debated whether to put this one in at all, but if you're a chemist, if you like doing chemistry, you'll like this test, because it basically tests for chlorides in your urine. And what does chloride have to do with adrenal function? Well, your adrenals also, in addition to producing cortisol and adrenaline, they produce a hormone called aldosterone. And aldosterone regulates your fluid balance and your sodium chloride balance. And when you're stressed out, you're peeing away a lot of your sodium, which is why a lot of people find that when they are really stressed, they crave salty things. And a lot of people get really good results by putting a pinch of sea salt in their water in the morning to just help support the adrenals. So we're measuring the output of chloride. It's an indirect measure of the function of your adrenals. And you're basically, you have a test tube, you put a drop of the Königsberg indicator, which is this, if you look at the picture on page, let's see, 32, towards the bottom, there's a picture of the two reagents. The potassium chromate is the Königsberg indicator. So you put one drop of that, and it's yellow. And then you put 10 drops of urine. It's really important to carefully calculate, titrate. And you mix well. You just put your finger over the top of it. You back and forth, but you don't shake it vigorously, just to make sure they go. Then you start adding the silver nitrate, and that's your titrating agent. And you add that one drop at a time, and you invert it after each drop. And what you're going to see is when the drop goes in, you'll see the yellow turn a little bit orange, but then it goes back to yellow as it gets absorbed in. And then you put another drop and it turns to yellow, it turns to orange, then goes back to yellow, turns to orange, then goes back to yellow. And you keep adding the drops and turning it over until you get to the point where it stays this kind of brick color, like an orange, not a bright, bright orange, but more of a brick brownish orange. When it stays that color and it doesn't go back to the yellow, you stop. And you count the number of drops you've used. And if it's normal, would be anywhere from 17 to 25. If you're in that sympathetic state, like on overdrive, adrenal stress state, it's going to be between 1 and 16. And if it's over 26, you're more in the sign of adrenal fatigue. Okay, and there's a phone number where you can order it. It's a pretty, it's a rough estimate, but it's a heck of a lot cheaper than the adrenal stress test. I tend to like the adrenal test with the saliva a lot more, but I use this as a basic screening with people, and it gives, sometimes I use it to let people know, you know, you really do need to do the adrenal stress test. So now we can see what your cycle is throughout the day, so we know, when should we give you some ashwagandha? What would be a good time for your B vitamins? What would be a good time for your licorice, if you can take it? Okay? So, any questions on those?
That's pretty clear.
Okay. And then the last section is the vitamins, minerals, and antioxidants. There's, on the minerals, there's the zinc assay test, the iodine skin test, and then there's this kit you can get called the Body Bio Mineral Kit. The zinc assay is a similar test pattern to the way you test the Bio Body Mineral Kit. The iodine skin test is, it's very controversial. And I have used it before. I've used it with some people where you paint a patch of iodine on the skin, and it's pretty bright yellow. And then you have them watch to see how long it takes that iodine skin patch to go away. If it goes away in under 24 hours, they are probably depleted in iodine. If it lasts longer, they are probably not. But the problem is a lot of things interfere with that. If you sweat, it's going to cause it to go down. If you tend to have a dark skin or be olive skinned or even have keratine looking skin, you know, somebody who drinks a lot of green smoothies or carrots and has that kind of orangey tone to the skin, it's not going to be as accurate. It's really hard to test this on, say, a black person, because you don't see it, really. It's not dark enough to really see and overcome their skin tone. Some say, like David Bronstein, Dr. David Bronstein is an MD, wrote a big book on iodine. He says it's hogwash. It doesn't really work. What I've seen, though, is I've had a few people who have done the test. It was really clear that it was gone within a few hours, and they hadn't taken a shower. And I said, just take the iodine and apply it topically. And every time it goes away, apply it again and apply it again. And what she discovered was, after a while, the iodine patch was lasting longer and longer and longer. And it's got to the point where it was over 24 hours. Does that mean that she was replete with iodine? Maybe. Maybe not. So, you know, research it. If it feels like something that you think you want to at least use as a general screening tool, you can. The zinc test is one that I use all the time. Again, there is some controversy about it, but I've found that it's a pretty good assessment. Somebody comes in, and you make sure they rinse their mouth out, and then you put a teaspoon of this zinc solution in it. You can get it from Premier Research Labs, from Metagenics, from Thorne, from Biotics. A lot of companies sell it. It's a zinc sulfate solution, and you swish it in your mouth, and you have the person hold it in their mouth until either 30 seconds has elapsed and they don't really taste much of anything, and then I would have them swallow it unless they're adverse to swallowing it, in which case they could spit. Or if it just tastes so foul within the first 10 seconds, you can let them spit it out at that point, because we've got our answer. So you put it in, and if the person makes it to 30 seconds and they don't taste it, or they very barely taste it, they probably have a pretty severe zinc deficiency. If they put it in their mouth and they immediately gag and spit it out, they probably don't need zinc. And then there's all kinds of shades in between. You supplement with them with zinc. You can either supplement with the liquid zinc, or you can supplement with a capsule of zinc, their preference. I tend to find the liquid zinc gets absorbed better, but it's more expensive. So you let the person make their decision, but then you give them how often to retest. Once a week is usually good. You should start to see changes pretty quickly. If you don't, within the first few weeks, you up their zinc dose. If you do, you maintain it until it tastes gross to them, and then you just stop the zinc, test it once a week, and find out how often they really need to take zinc. A lot of these minerals, like the ones that build up in our body, like the minerals and the fat-soluble vitamins, you don't need to take every day. You may only need to take it once a month. I take B12 once a month. I take my D maybe once a week, just because I can't be bothered with every day. But I know that they can get stored And same thing with minerals if you're replete. But if you're not replete, then you don't want to take it. If you're just taking it to maintain your level, you might be able to take it every week or two or three. But if you've got a deficiency, yeah, you do need to take it every day. So that's basically how you do the zinc test. And then there's a description here of what it means and how much you should be giving them. And then the iodine I've already described, and there's some charts. The BioBody mineral tests, a lot of doctors that treat autistic kids use these because it's a good way of assessing how their minerals are. And typically kids who are autistic are have, you know, very bad digestion. They have low mineral status, and it's really amazing to use these. Now, some people have asked me, what about, like, liquid chromium? Can I take liquid chromium instead of capsules of chromium for my blood sugar? And the answer I give is, I don't know. Because I haven't, there's not a lot of research on it. There's tons of research on chromium polynucleinate reversing insulin resistance. There's not a whole lot on this. But our Beatrice has found that she gets a result. She can get her blood pressure, her blood sugars lowered with taking some liquid chromium. Had another client, same thing. She found that if she did a no-no and her blood sugar went up, she'd, oh darn, she'd go ahead and take some drops of the liquid chromium.
It really makes me feel better too.
So the whole thing, the whole idea is that the liquid gets absorbed so much better and
you
get it in.
The liquid magnesium, also the angstrom magnesium.
Mm-hmm.
No comparison, I just take it.
So it's just really, there's not a lot of hard evidence in terms of scientific studies, but sometimes the empirical evidence is just as fine. If you're feeling like you feel better when you do this.
Dr. Marie, the problem with the liquid angstroms, magnesium and chromium, is that I have no idea how much I'm taking.
Exactly. That's the reason
exactly. Yeah, the recommended dosage, and I'm very careful not to go above that, but I have no idea. I've tried figuring it out, and I come out with 3 milligrams or something like that.
I know. I've done the same thing, and I go, huh? What the heck good is 10 milligrams of calcium going to do? But if it's in small particle size and it gets in the right place at the right time, we really don't need quite as much as we think we do. It's absorption problems that cause us to think we need more.
Yeah, come on. Sorry, I'm just, okay. Sorry, I've just got builders trying to talk to me. Sorry about that.
Oh, okay. I thought you were asking a question. So on these mineral tests, you do them very similarly to the way you do the zinc. It comes with a kit. It comes with a little pads that you can write it in. And it's all described here, so I'm not going to spend a lot of time. It's very, very simple to do. It's swishing it in your mouth, noting the sensation. They give you a little check sheet that you go, you know, is it sweet? Is it slightly sweet? Is it bitter? Is it horrible? Is it, you know, tasteless? And then you can calculate how much you need or how deficient you might be or if you're just fine. So I just put in all the information from the company's brochure that you can read about in there. And it's a straightforward test people can do at home.
Looks very pretty. I like the pretty bottles.
What's that?
I like all the pretty bottles. I like,
It's kind of fun because I can sit there with someone. You can have them do it at home and get their own kit. But I was sitting there with people and just across from them and saying, okay, taste this. Let's put that in water. And I've done this with groups. I did this on a program we did, and we did 7 at a time. And it was amazing to see the differences. One person says, that tastes like water. No, it doesn't. It tastes sweet. And it's the exact same substance. Exactly. And the same thing with those pH things. You know, they're like, oh, that tastes this way. No, it doesn't. So anyway, I think that's all I wanted to go over today. And then if you have any questions, you can ask them. I have a list of supplies, page 60. There's a list of supplies where you can get all these things. There are some other tests which I chose not to put in there because they're more complicated and you wouldn't want a person to do at home. But if you're a practitioner and you can get people in an office, actually I think you have to, I'm not sure what your license needs to be, you'd have to check, but there's one where you can actually have them swallow a pH strip on a string. It's a little kit you get and you can test the pH of their stomach. So, but it's invasive because then you have to, you know, they have to swallow it and then they're not going to pull it back up and you got to pull it back up and, you know, it's a liability. So you, if you can send them home with it and have them do it with a family member. Anyway, I chose not to put it in here just because I thought it would be kind of, you know.
Dr. Rita Marie, you're right about that. And you, if you live in the United States, you have to check state is different.
Yep.
For example, in Florida, I'm a Reiki master. I can't even do Reiki unless I'm a massage therapist.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or
so you have to go get a massage therapy license if you want to even put people...
Or if I am a preacher. So I
can... Oh.
That's
interesting, yeah. That's interesting.
They're considering the laying of the hands, but even though in Reiki you don't touch anything or anyone.
Touch.
But if you're a preacher, so someone said get on the internet and get a preacher.
Oh, yeah. Getting a preacher's license is much easier than getting a massage therapy license.
Yes.
And a lot less expensive. You send somebody $50 for the paperwork and you're done.
Right. So, yes, be very careful of what you can or cannot do.
Yeah. And what your words. This is assessments. These are evaluations. These are things people can do at home. And, you know, just be careful. You're not diagnosing. You're just giving them a functional insight into how their body's working. Yeah?
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, good. Well, thank you guys for hanging out there. Hopefully this recording took.
I hope it did.
We'll at least be able to listen to it. So, yeah. Well, I was planning to, but we're running out of time. I just wanted to give you just a quick insight as to what I've been working on, because I've been working on this hard, and you guys think every time I get on a call, well, I don't have the details yet of the practitioner program, but it's because I've been just kind of going through it, and no, I don't want to do it that way. And I really feel like I've got it down, and I'll be putting it on, you know, really fleshing it out on paper very soon. I feel like I'm not going to change it again, at least in the short term. But I'm so excited because it's going to be a way for you to create the skills so you feel really confident working with people and getting results and understanding the inner workings of the body much more deeply than some people who are just really good at telling people, well, you need to eat well and exercise, which, of course, we know is the basics of everything, right? But a lot of people will come in and say, well, I'm already eating a lot of fruits and vegetables. Why am I still tired? And it would be nice to be able to dig and know why. It's always nice when just eating fresh fruits and vegetables solves everybody's problems. And that happens to a lot of people. But what about when it doesn't?
Different people have a different idea of what eating well means.
Oh, yeah.
For a lot of people, eating well means half a pound of steak.
They have steak and they have vegetables and they have potatoes.
And they have
right?
vegetables that are overcooked and limp as...
Well, no, even if they're eating fresh vegetables, they're still not balancing it the way we know how. So we have the advantage of being able to go in there. So the program is going to give you the tools that you need to assess people to see where they're at, not diagnose, but assess to get an idea, and to motivate them, to have tools to inspire them, to understand all the nutrients and how they play out and how you can see based on symptomatology and the way somebody presents what might be going on, when to refer them out, when it's beyond your scope, that's really important, but to really learn to get results. And you're going to do that by having really great tools to work with and protocols. But also, what I think is really important is that you need to be a shining example yourself. You need to be what you're teaching them. And so that's why included in the practitioner program is my energy recharge coaching program. And what I've just worked out and I'm thrilled with, because I was going through how I do this without making it too complicated. The way it's going to work is all of the lifestyle lessons within the energy recharge program will have here's the basics, here's the advanced, and here's the practitioner level. Well, if you're a practitioner, you're going to see that button that you can press, and then you're going to get, okay, we just talked about hydration. Here's some tricks, and here's why, and here's the background, and here's how you're going to work with this with your people. And here's some checklists, and here's some handouts, and everyone will be a little bit different, but you'll get the tools and the understanding that you need to put into place all the foundational lifestyle pieces. So immediately upon you starting the program, you're going to have more insights. Every single time you go through a new lesson, you go, oh, I could use this with this person over here. I could use this with this person over here. When you're finished, you'll be able to pull it together and systematically go through. But in addition to those pieces, we're going to have breakout workshops similar to like this where we'll be on the phone together. We may be doing, hopefully we'll be doing more with the video conferencing so you could see. And learn about, okay, digestion, soup to nuts on digestion. How are we assessing it? How are we going to know what's going on? What do we do when we know that? How do we deal with when somebody says, but I can't swallow pills. I don't want to take supplements. I don't like vegetables. You know, just all that stuff and how to deal with it within each of the frameworks of the organ and gland systems. But on top of that, the other piece that I kept feeling was missing is that you need to be able to then build a thriving practice with this and know, how do you enroll people? How do you put together programs that engage people? How do you find the people to get in? How do you put together teleseminars and coaching programs if you wanted to do group kinds of things, and et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to have a business piece as well where I'll share everything that I've known, resources that I've done, and teachers that I've had, because I have spent probably well over $100,000 in my education over the past couple of years, 3 years, in learning how to do this and how to put it together. And I'm talking the marketing and the business piece, so that I could go from having a hobby at home, which maybe some of you do right now, where you give people advice for free or they pay you $10 or they make you dinner, to actually having a business that supports your family and puts food on your table and allows you a lifestyle. So I want to share that and, you know, expose you to other mentors. So there'll be a process. We'll get started with the energy recharge piece. Then we're going to do an assessment certification program. So you'll get certified in assessments and lab right there in the middle of the program before the program even ends. And then we're going to go through all the other pieces, and I have a layout, and I'll put it all on paper so you can see it. So I'm excited, and I just want to get from you, the small group, how does this sound? Does this sound like something that would turn you on?
For me, it sounds that I'm sorry I didn't have it when my kids were little. because it's so applicable not only to other people, but to everyday life.
It's to raising your family. And all those years when it was a hobby more to me, that I wasn't making a lot of money at it, that I used it on my kids. I mean, I kept my kids in pristine health. I helped other people with their kids. I talked to people at mom's groups. So, yes, you're right. This is going to be stuff that you're going to be able to use.
I mean, right now I wouldn't use that because my sons are both married, so I can't stick my nose in there.
Right, you're not going to be doing it. Yeah, but you would do it with people who are coming in. They're coming in. Like, everybody's going to have a front door, and I'm going to really help you to see that, the importance of that. Your front door, Beatrice, is the meditation.
Meditation, yes.
Right. My front door for all these years when I was just in the brick-and-mortar chiropractic office was pain. My front door was people in pain. And then I quickly got them to see that their pain was related to their nutrition, and then we would go into nutritional protocols. But, you know, I got to the point where people came to me because they had digestive problems or allergies or whatever. But initially, because that was my front door license, that was where it was. And you meet people where your expertise is and where they are coming in, and then you expose. And then from there, you can create, you know, what people are coming for. But right now, mostly people are coming to me because they don't have energy, their hormones are out of whack, their digestion sucks, and they want help with that.
But you know, Dr. Yumi, you're right, because when I was teaching at MD Anderson Cancer Center, I was teaching cancer patients or their caretakers, and they would ask me in the meditation classes what they could take for the nausea.
Yep.
After the chemotherapy.
Yep.
And I would say, what, I don't know what you can do, but ask your doctor if you can have a little bit of ginger tea.
Yeah, yeah, and that's a great way to put it, right? I can't tell you what to do, but I've seen people get results with, exactly.
So people tend to ask questions about what's going wrong in whatever setting they are where they feel comfortable.
Yes, and you guys, and I'm going to interview everybody because I'm just not letting everybody just go to the internet and sign up for this program. Everybody, I'm going to handpick who I want to be in this program because I really want people who have a really great bedside manner, if you know what I mean, that are really into really loving that person and really seeing how you can help them and moving them into potential. I don't want somebody who just wants to give people vitamins and send them on their way and see them for 10 or 15 minutes and, you know, send them on their way with a set of vitamins. I really want to turn out people. If I'm going to put my seal of approval in my name and say, this person is certified, then I want that person to not just have the knowledge and the skills, but to have the heart. That's super important to me. And the connection, the ability to connect with people. Because that's number one. People have to learn to trust you. So, anyway, I'll get off my soapbox. You guys have been here a very long time, and I want to say goodbye and thank you so much for being here. Thank you for being patient with our thwarted half hour at the beginning with the technology issues, and I think it worked out okay without all that. Was that okay for everybody?
Yeah, great.
Thank you. Thank you for your patience and persistence.
Thank you, Dr. Rita Marie. Enjoy your vacation.
You're so welcome. I'm not on vacation. I'm actually here for a conference, but I like to think of it as a vacation.
Okay.
And I'm going to enjoy spending a little time with Beverly. So you guys take care and have a great evening.
Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you.
Bye. Goodbye, everyone. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye. Bye.